grab a cocktail or a cold Coca-Cola or cold Coca-Cola product on your way over. So if y'all could kind of start making your way this way. All right, maybe if y'all want to keep coming, keep coming. Don't be shy. Don't be shy. All right, well, first of all, let me say a warm welcome to everyone. I know it is a very cold night, as I've told many people, having lived in Russia for several years. This is a nice March afternoon, so no worries for that. What I wanted to do was talk quickly about the flow of events for the night. First of all, we're going to have some prepared remarks by Muhtar and then Q&A with the leadership team that we have here. Then we're going to have some time for additional mixing and mingling, more cocktails. We have plenty of nice food in the back. And then importantly, hopefully you've noticed by now, we have several innovation stations. And I really would like to encourage you to take some time to stop by each of them. We have members from our R&D and VEB team over to my left that are here, happy to walk you through each of the different products and all of the things and great things that we have going on. And then, like I said, we'll have some time for mixing and mingling, and then we'll wrap up around 7:30. So with that, I'm gonna turn the stage over to Muhtar.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Tim, and welcome all of you. What a wonderful time of the year, and we've done these gatherings at this time of the year before, and it is a good time to get together. And I wanted you, all of you, to know how much we, all of us at Coca-Cola, appreciate your interest, your investment, and also your analysis of our company. Means a lot to us. It's granted that's maybe a part of your job, but we still appreciate it very much. Our goal tonight is to give you, in a way, a greater insight to our business. If we can do that in the time frame, I've got several colleagues here, associates and colleagues of mine in our senior leadership team to help me do that. Of course, starting with our President and Chief Operating Officer, James Quincy, our Chief Financial Officer, Kathy Waller, our Chief Marketing Officer, Marcos De Quinto, our Chief Strategy Officer, Brent Hasty, our Chief Commercial and Customer Officer, Julie Hamilton, and our Chief Public Affairs Officer, Clyde Tuggle. We have all of them here. An exciting and important announcement. Last Friday, our President and Chief Operating Officer, James Quincy, will become CEO at the beginning of May 2017. Give him a hand, James. I have every single belief that James is the right person for the job. He has a long, very long and distinguished track record in our company, 20 years. Of those 20 years, I have known him personally very well. Of the 10 of those 20 years, he's had key leadership roles in the south of Latin America, based in Argentina. Then also, he started off in Atlanta, then in Mexico. Then I was instrumental in moving him to Europe, our chief, our biggest profit pool. And then recently, about 16 months ago, into the role of Chief Operating Officer and my partner. And I'm very, very proud, personally very, very proud. I want all of you to know of having James come in as CEO. Exactly the right person, the right person that we can all count on, all of you can count on, and I will give him my full support as chairman. So the question is, why now, maybe? And we've led our business through an incredible transformation in recent years, really big transformation, the transformation of the company, our bottling system. And it is so much, in a way, more than just refranchising. We've revitalized our capability. We've revitalized our brands, revitalized our portfolio. We revitalized our cost base, we revitalized our marketing, and we revitalized our bottling system. And it's not just franchising. When you think about, of course it's North America, but look at Asia, look at Philippines, look at Japan, look at China, look at Europe, look at Latin America. It's not, it's about 50% in the last, starting in 2015, 2016, all through to the end of 2017, 50% of our global bottling system will have changed hands in one way or another, reconfigured, of a $140, $35 billion revenue system, changing hands, getting better, getting stronger, getting in more capable hands, and getting into a mode of being hungrier and better to serve our customers, to serve our 25 million retailers. Not to say that not to mention that in the last 7-8 years we've added eight more billion dollar brands. We've had 37 consecutive quarters of share gains, and we've added 500 plus million incremental servings per day to this business. 500 million incremental servings. And so, throughout all this period, we've delivered $100 billion of shareholder value, representing a total return of over 100%. So a strong foundation. Very proud of what has been done and the transformation, a transformation where we will have shed in the final analysis maybe about $20, $25 billion of revenue and increased our operating margin by 1,200 basis points when the calendar reads December 31, 2017. And so a complete transformation of the company. And so back to the question of why now, because this is definitely the right time, I believe. And, you know, I think in the end, the single most important thing a leader can do anywhere, in business, in politics, anywhere, in family, is who you leave the keys to and the people that you leave behind. And I am so confident with the leadership of James. He knows our brands. He knows our values, our people, our bottlers, our customers, our beverage landscape. And he is the right person to deliver it to the next level. And this is hard work. And CEO transition is never the work of 6 months, a year, 2 years, or 3 years. Within 12 months after I became CEO, 8.5 years ago from now back, I started working with our management development committee about the cater of our capability in socializing that capability with the management development committee. So it is hard work and a long-term work. And so this is the time that I believe that is the right time to hand the responsibilities and the keys to someone that I know will take it to the next level. And not only take it to the next level, but create increasing shareholder value, stakeholder value across all our stakeholders, starting with our share owners, but also our employees, our customers, our bottling partners, our consumers, the NGO partners. And often you've heard me say the best way to describe the Coca-Cola business is power of partnerships. Those incredible partnerships we have with our bottlers, with our customers, with civil society, NGOs, and we strive continuously to create stakeholder value and shareholder value for all of those stakeholders. So thank you for being here. I want to just thank you again for your interest, for your support over the last 8.5 years for me, for the company, for your interest, and now we're going to have a Q&A. But thank you very much. Thank you. Cheers. So let me invite James, let me invite Kathy to come up, and we will try to address and answer your questions at this very exciting time for our enterprise and for the future of our system. So shoot away, and Brian?
Practice getting in this chair.
Thank you. Thanks, Buttar. You touched on just how different the company is going to be when you turn the keys over versus what it was when you started the succession process. So could you kind of talk about how you approached the succession planning, and was there anything different you had to do there in order to make sure that you were going to put James in the position?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think it was it's a long process, not 1 year, 2 years, 1 month, 6 months, long process, hard work, a lot of dialogue with our management development committee headed by Herbert Allen and our board, and tapping into the head of Europe, bringing him in as the president and chief operating officer. He's done a great job over the last 15, 16 months running the operations of the companies, and also I think has exactly what I said, all the knowledge about the values, the brands, the company, the system, the landscape, and also the attitude to take this company to the next level. And that's why I decided at the age of 64 that this is a good run. I've been with the company for 38 years. I've been CEO for 8.5 years. When I hand the baton, it'll be 9 years. For me, my legacy is not all of those things I mentioned, but my legacy is how, under the leadership, capable leadership of James, this company succeeds not in 2017 only, but 2017, 18, 19, 20, and years ahead. And I am fully confident that that's going to take place and happen. And that's why I decided this is the best time, and there is no better time. When you look at the world of agriculture, which we're so involved in, we are the largest curator of lemons in the world. We have more lemon trees under plantation. There's only one best time when you decide when to harvest, and that was the best time for me to choose, and there's no better time. This is the perfect time.
We hope it's not 11, though.
Wow. Perfect time.
Last better time he made olive. The comment, I was an olive. Squeezed and hot.
But it's the timing we're talking about. The timing is the best time. There's only, you choose that time once.
No, I'm not for living in lemons anymore.
Yes, Judy.
Thank you. So, Muttar, you talked a lot about the transformations that the company has gone through. I guess from some of the outsider's view, there's still some perceptions that Coke is a little bit more risk-averse, maybe slower to change. So maybe, James, what do you think that you really can do to maybe speed up some of the decision-making processes or anything that can give confidence that things can actually move more quickly? Because I think you're actually known to be someone who can make decisions maybe more quickly.
Oh. Wow. Look, I think we've been on an accelerating path. I think if you just go back to some of the examples that Muttar used, we've been trying to make the relatively simple growth model work faster. We focus on consumer-centric brands. We achieve pervasive and hopefully advantaged distribution. We create shared value ourselves, the bottlers, the customers, the community. And then we attract people to invest. And I think what's been happening is that flywheel has been spinning up. And as it's been spinning up, of course, the macros have got harder. So it's been harder to see. And the refranchising, we understand, makes the numbers complicated to see as we make the system stronger. And as Muttar said, half the system's in motion. But in the end, we're making a stronger company. And I think that will eventually play through. We've talked this year in some of the earnings calls about how the developed markets are doing much better than the emerging markets. So I think the proof points are starting to build, and we're going to continue to make the decisions we need to make that go faster. Staying on the consumer stuff, I mean, getting more real and more focused on addressing the sparkling sugar problems. You can see in the station over there, the one brand strategy. Marcus is here. We've been pushing out a lot of, you know, if you compare that to the previous 129 years of our history, all of what's happened in the last year is very radical compared to what we've done historically. And we've got more to push through and more to do and more aggressive ways of rolling that out in 2017. And similarly on the stills, we've been branching out from our starting points. Perhaps, you know, juice and water were a little too volumetrically the right places to go in the previous mindset. We're much more revenue focused now, looking at the higher value parts. I mean, if you look around the room, the message is in the stands in the room, in the sorts of things we're going after. Going after those things that are more on trend, more high value, more margin, better margin comparisons are sparkling. So I think, you know, it's the part of the problem is the law of big numbers. Having an effect on the total aggregate number of Coke takes some doing, but the thing is spooling up. And that's what's going to drive the ability to get the distribution, to get the advantage in the execution, and to make the flywheel keep going.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I guess for both of you, I mean, and this could be a question of 9 months ago, but why James in terms of, was there something in his resume over the past 5-10 years that he really did well, or was there something you're particularly, some challenge in the past 5-10 years that, boy, it was such a challenge and we overcame, or was it his perspective on pricing and driving the price points, or, you know, what, was there something there, or was just, it was the whole body of work over the past, say, 20 years?
Yeah, you know, James was one of the group presidents that we elevated after he ran Mexico successfully for a number of years. And amongst those, that, you know, group presidents are those who basically try to ensure that the right strategies at a slightly higher altitude than our business unit presidents. The Coca-Cola Company is comprised of 17 business units around the world. They kind of guide strategically and bring the best out of the business unit presidents so they execute flawlessly. That's the role of a group president. And I think, you know, James in Europe, for me, certainly, lived very much up to that expectation and more. He was very much instrumental in convincing me architecture of Coca-Cola European Partners. That is, again, yet another huge bottling system that has completely revitalized itself in the biggest profit pool we have in the world, which is Europe. And so, and I've followed his career over the last 10 years since I came back to the company, of the 10 of the 12 years, very closely. And I decided, yes, this is the person that I would like to entrust all of this great foundation to take it to the next level. And we jumped, in a way, a layer when we did that. And I think we're going to see the benefits of that. And I, for me, as I said, I repeat, my simple legacy will be how well this company under his leadership does in 2017, 18, 19, 20, and beyond. And I'm convinced that this company will do great with everything that is in the pipeline, both revitalized brands, revitalized portfolio. When you think of the U.S. business, I had a fundamental belief that the United States business, we could not succeed in the world, no matter how well the world did, if we didn't succeed in the United States, our flagship market. We had 8-9 years ago, our stills portfolio was 7% of the total of NARTD. Today it's 27% of the total. And it's the most dynamic, it's the fastest growing. We're the consistently the fastest growing stills business in the United States with all the brands, from Simply to Honest Tea to Zico to Fairlife to everything that you see here. There it is on that side. So, and I think, you know, the flagship businesses have to perform really well. And as James said, this year, it's fascinating because the emerging markets in challenging mode that are actually developed businesses, Japan, Europe, United States in revenue growth are actually far exceeding some of the emerging markets. Now, I think, you know, over time, the equilibrium will start playing. But I'm much happier that our developed businesses that have much higher revenue per case, much higher revenue per liter, are doing much better, because others will come back. James, you want to add anything about your experience?
I think you did a great job on that one. I think definitely E, all of the above. And in the end, you'd expect it to be E, all of the above, because you'd never choose a one-trick pony. So I think it really has to be E, all of the above.
Yes, Caroline.
Thank you. Congratulations to both
of you.
My question's on China. There's a major refranchising underway where you're giving, my understanding is that the Coca-Cola company will be out of the bottling business there completely, correct?
Yes. Correct.
And could you explain why you were there, why this is the moment for you to exit, and how you think the next 5 to 10 years look in China, which has proven to be an incredibly competitive market, very much a four quadrant, water's big, tea's big, juices are big, and it feels like Japan, where you've been massively successful in that you need innovation all the time, but it's been harder for you to do that in China. Why is that? Is that going to be different going forward?
Sure. There's a few questions.
Yeah, maybe I should start with why we got into the bottling business. Simply because the Kwok family wanted out, because they were putting all their money into the hotels, and I did a deal with Robert Kwok at that time to buy that business back from him. Back 7-8 years ago, I think it was. So that was the why, and we wanted to be sure that we can have our hand under the stone leading the bottlers in China that were really getting used to being a bottler in China, because everything was so new at that time, and it was opening up. So that is the why. Today, our bottlers in China, Swire, as well as COFCO, Coca-Cola, COFCO, are so well developed, so well led, so capable in leadership that we don't see ourselves as. And then also to get the bottlers into the stills business, we had to be involved in China. That's how we launched, you know, we're able to get Pulpy launched and all the other still beverages. So, and I think, you know, now in your quadrants, I would urge you also to look at the profit pools in those quadrants. And so the profit pools, you know, are not one-fourth, one-fourth, one-fourth. They're very different in terms of the percentages. And so, you know, one has to really select what profit pools, which quadrants you play in China in order to generate value. And I'll stop there and have James maybe comment on his thoughts on that.
I think a couple of thoughts on China and then connect to Japan. I mean, China, we've chosen to win in sparkling. It's the thing we know how to do and get right. There are other categories that are reasonably well developed, and I would underline Muta's point. The profitability of some of those is not close to what sparkling is. But there's still plenty of growth left in China. There's plenty of growth in the big cities where they're premiumizing and they're starting to look more like the developed world, and there's a vast amount of growth in the rural and the third tier cities. But let me go back to your reference point of Japan. Japan, first of all, was not developed in 10 years, and secondly, wasn't born as a five-category business. It actually started off as sparkling. It started off as one category, and then it became two, and then 10 years later or 20 years later, it became three and four and five. And actually, you can look at the chart of Japan, and each one starts to layer on over time and takes a good number of years to develop. So we should not have the expectation that we can create Japan in China in the next few years. It's not going to happen that way, at least not organically. But we have to focus on building that business over time in the same way we did in Japan. Now, clearly the competitive landscape is slightly different in China, and the amount of time available is slightly different, so the plan won't look the same. But we will have to build ourselves from one category into other categories where we have a good brand proposition and some competitive advantage, because it is a very competitive environment. But it continues to grow, notwithstanding, you know, what happened in the first half and the ups and downs. It's bouncing back. So we're still very positive on China in the long term, but we will have to build the businesses. And in the end, just to kind of round out by going back to Japan, as we think about our portfolio and you look at us and say it's a sparkling business that actually, you know, was 90%+ sparkling 10, 15 years ago and is now down towards the 70s. And if you started counting revenue and other things, it'd start to get to be an even lower number. You know, think about it like this. Most people look at Japan and see that as the exception in the Coke business. But why can't it be the example? And that's what we've got to think about for some of these other places. If we had five category streams and one of them be sparkling, it would be a very much bigger business.
Maybe the final thing on China is that the whole digitization of China is going to make China look like a very different development curve in terms of where it's going compared to Japan when it developed those categories. There will be much quicker shifts between categories, between products, between brands, because of the enormous sort of mountain of digitization that's happening in first and second and third tier cities in China right now. Yeah, right here.
Two quick ones. First, Kathy, for Christmas, I just want a modeling call because I'm having an impossible time with 2017. So just wondering if you're going to help us anytime soon. James, just I know it's kind of a cheesy question, but how are you going to define success, you know, during your tenure?
Well, first, Santa will take your wish under consideration, and we will be in touch about that.
He might not arrive on the 25th, though.
No, I doubt it.
Yeah, look, in a way, success is a repeat. In X years, let's say 10 for the sake of the argument, I get to stand here and say my greatest legacy is 10 years of success and a successor who's going to create another 10 years of success. And so you have to get, except with a cheesy question, you get a slightly simple answer. But that, in the end, will be the thing. I mean, and it will be different. I mean, I joke when I talk to Muta, it's like, because I talk about, you know, the digitization of the business is going to be radically different over the next 10 years, because effectively, when Muta started, the iPhone didn't exist. I mean, we all sit here like it's been there forever, but actually, when Muta started CEO, it basically didn't exist. So there'll be something radically different about our business by the time I leave, and hopefully it'll be a long, multi-hundred billion dollars of success in shareholder returns and a successful handing over the baton.
Yeah, over here, please, on the right, and then we'll come to you. Yeah, thanks.
Congratulations to both. Laurent Grandet from Credit Suisse. Muta, if anything, I mean, did you would like to share about something you have missed for the last 8 years, or you think you could have done better? That would give us maybe a sense of maybe where to go. And James, potentially, I mean, how do you think about, I mean, moving innovation much faster from one country to another or from one region to like a test and learn model?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, would I have done anything, what would I have done differently? I would say probably what I would have done differently is to embark upon the refranchising quicker after we purchased CCE. I think there was just too much of integration and synergy work that had took place. So, but I think at the end of the day, my task was to reinvigorate the U.S. business. CCE was, you know, a kind of a degenerative model over 30 years, and it could not, it just was not sustainable from the, you know, U.S. market point of view. We were just losing incidents. We were losing, you know, the consumer. 115% of the growth was coming from upsizing, and the brands were, you know, not being polished of our company. And so my whole architecture was, how do we get the U.S. business back to growth, but at the same time, you know, we changed the perpetual contract that was kind of a, you know, something that was tied to our feet, and then also reinvigorate the business and the brands. And I think we have got there. I would have liked to get there just a couple of years before. And it just took, this takes a long time because of the the architecture that you have to create to serve the customer better. So you don't, no bottler can now actually come in the way of a, for the top 50 customers in the United States, we can cut a annual business plan and a deal at the customer governance model allows us to do that. We didn't have that before. A bottler that didn't produce, that was very small, somewhere could stop us. One language IT and one production governance model so that we can be the 21st century. Those things just took longer than I wanted. But, you know, if we got those wrong, James would have the same problem in 3 years' time. So, you know, it's in a way frustrating, but it just took the amount of time. So from my perspective, you know, that, and then also, you know, I wish I could have brought Marcos a year or two earlier, and this one brand strategy would have happened just 18, 24 months before. Because I'm a huge believer. You know, the way the one brand strategy developed was we were in Arizona with all the bottlers 3 years ago. And we visited stores, and then we got together in a room, and we said, look, what is it what we're seeing here? We're losing red. We're losing, you know. So it wasn't out of a huge strategic. It was just a simple thing. We're losing red in the supermarket because everything's becoming silver and black. And I said, you know, just like Ferrari never wants to lose red, we don't want to lose red. It's our heritage. And so one brand strategy was developed, then the whole strategy came behind it, which was brought in by Marcos when he became the chief marketing officer. And I'm a huge believer in the small packages that I think James should talk about and what's happening in the United States and elsewhere now in the world. Because the consumer, for the first time in years, teen incidence for brand Coke is growing in the United States. It hasn't happened before. Why is that happening? Because they're saying, I like, give it to me in small packages, and I love this brand. I love it. I love the indulgence. But I didn't like 20 ounce. I didn't like, you know, 2.5 liters or 2 liters. There's not enough carbonation left. There's not enough drinks. And so, you know, again, I think, you know, James should talk to you about the whole revenue side of sparkling, because what people don't get is how robust the revenue side of sparkling is. And, of course, you're not going to have for a number of years big volume growth when you're downsizing. It's just the math.
What was the second half of the question?
The second half was about innovation. How you plan to move? I mean, faster from, you know, one country to the other, or region to the other.
So let me perhaps tie the two things together. I mean, the simple fact is that we moved away from one of the core simple ideas that drove the cycle of growth, which was the small, affordable entry pack. The system around the world got obsessed with 500 ml, 20 ounce, 2 liters. And that's great and very profitable for existing consumers, but they're not recruitment packs. And so in the end, the nexus of helping people control the amount of sugar, helping them downsize the size of the package to something that's an entry pack, the small package, like the one right in front of you, is the perfect vehicle, and it's a revenue-generating vehicle. So we're pushing that around, which actually connects back to the second half of your question, which is what do we need to do in terms of driving innovation? We're going to be more pushy from the center on driving the business forward on those few things that we believe are core and strategic to the future success of the company. Bearing in mind, why is that important? Because the simple way I would say it is, you know, if you go back, Coke went global before globalization. It went global before internet, that leads mobile phones, computers, telephones, everything. The only way that you got communicated was at best with a telex. And the way that worked is, you're now in charge of country X. Go away. Good luck. There's only two rules. You can't change the formula, and you can't steal the money. Please come back once a year and tell me how it's going. I mean, that was the model for 100 and something years. So it was very entrepreneurial and very decentralized. And so for us to be able to drive innovation, we've been on a journey for the last number of years to not lose that entrepreneurship, but leverage it when we know what the answer is globally. There will always be lots of local activations and lots of local brands and lots of local innovation that then needs to be scaled. But the key is to be able to identify it and move it faster, and that requires a more pushy center to say, these five things, these have to move faster. And smaller packages are one of them.
In a way, how Coke Zero moved so fast across our system back seven years ago. And, you know, it was first launched in a white label in the United States. Some of you may remember that. And then we said, no, black label. And that's how it kind of get pushed. And you know, now, you know, Coke with no sugar in Britain, I mean, it's just doing, it's just so strong. Why do you wait? You know, as James said, you just know something is working, just move rapidly. Right over there.
James, given all the changes in the company and also in the marketplace, should we expect you to refresh the 2020 vision? And as you look at the various components of it, which one are going to be the key priorities?
Certainly, by the time we get to 2020, we will have refreshed the vision. But I don't think that would obey the maximum of Judy's faster decision making. Look, actually, you know, when you look back at the history of visions at Coke, you know, there was one in the 80s, there was one in the 90s, there was one in the noughties, and there was Vision 2020. But I think where the world we're heading into is, especially in the slightly weirder macro environment, is it going to be a little more organic. I don't see us necessarily coming out and saying this in a very precise kind of circuit diagram way is how the next 10 years will work. I think it's going to be too volatile, too much uncertainty. We're going to need to be more fluid, more adaptable. Yes, the corridors are going to remain the same. Yes, the growth model of consumer-centric brands, you know, pervasive and advantage distribution, shared value, and getting people to reinvest will remain true. But we need to set ourselves some corridors that we think are going to be true, and we're going to adapt, and they're going to change. And trying to prescribe exactly what that's going to look like in the next 10 years is like trying to say, what's the next iPhone going to be in 10 years' time? That's a bet that's too hard to make. What we do know is digitization is going to change everything. It's going to change the way we interact with consumers. It's going to change the way we interact with customers. It's going to change the way we operate the business. Exactly how that works, we've got ideas for the next year, the next 3 years, and bets going forward. But I don't think we want to be prescriptive all the way out to the future. So it's going to be a little more organic. It's going to be a little more fluid because it needs to be more adaptable.
Was there a question in the front here? Did you have a question? No, you're good? Right here in the middle.
Great. Two questions.
James.
Two questions, perhaps related. You know, way out in the future, let's say, perhaps, you know, when you're at the end of your tenure, and if at that point sparkling was, let's say, 50% of the sales mix, would you think that's a success or a failure? And second question. Can you talk a little bit about how you see coffee playing out in the Coke portfolio long term? I know there's a lot of excitement around Dunkin', and love to get your thoughts on that.
So the answer to the 50-50, of course, the answer is like, well, what's happened to the other critical variable? What's the value of 100%? If the value of 100% is five times what it is today, everyone in this room is going to be happy. If it's the same number, no one's going to be happy. So the key thing is, can we generate revenue growth at the top line sustainably from the total portfolio? Then, in all honesty, assuming some degree of margin management of all the different beverages, we have to be a little more agnostic of from what categories it comes from. I mean, said in the most brutally simple terms, if we can double and triple and quadruple revenue into the future, does Coke will always be the heart and the soul of the company, but it doesn't have to be 70% of the revenues, and it probably won't be. And it'd probably be okay that Gold Peak Coffee is your favorite brand, because that's what's going to allow us to stay on the money with the consumer. If we stay on the money with the consumer, the customers will support us, and that's what will drive the revenue. I mean, that's why we're the fastest growing large per cap consumer company in grocery retail, adding money for the retailers. Why are they working with us? Because we're generating money for them. Why? Because we're on track with consumers. So it's all going to work together, and that's what's going to drive the top number. And then the portfolio will be a combination of us making relevant the favorite brands that already exist, and us bringing new things that are on trend for the consumers. And what the number ends up being is will be whatever the consumer buys.
Didi, Dunkin' Donuts?
Oh, Dunkin' Donuts. I don't have a bottle, but it's coming soon.
But he has a question.
What was it? Oh, what's the future of coffee?
No, Dunkin' Donuts. Are you excited?
How do you see the portfolio?
I'm very excited about ready-to-drink coffee. We're the global leader in ready-to-drink coffee, just to be clear. Now, we have to admit, it's all largely in Japan. But that means the current ready-to-drink coffee business is all largely in Japan. We think that there's a lot of space in the US to come in with a few options. Not one, but a few, to get into this space. We're going to take Dunkin'. It's a great brand. It's an interesting coffee. We're going to put Gold Peak Coffee out there as well, and come up with a portfolio of solutions to make coffee more interesting for the retailers and for the consumers, because it's that nexus of the consumer's interest and the value proposition for the customers that's going to get us to move forward. So we think it's going to be interesting, and we're going to give it a try.
And, you know, we moved Dunkin' to Korea four or five years ago.
Georgia.
Georgia to Korea 4 or 5 years ago, and it's done great.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, it's now... a more than a $150 million brand there, Georgia Coffee in Korea.
I think you're getting the last question signed from...
right here in the front.
Okay, so I'll do a 3-for-1 then. James, what do you think about the energy category? Kathy, what do you think about corporate tax reform and the ability to move where you produce concentrate? And Muhtar, as you become the chairman of the company, or move to solely the chairman of the company, what's your focus on managing enterprise risk?
Mm. Wow. Are you sure we shouldn't have cut it off over time?
So in that order.
Look, I got the simplest question. We've got a clear partnership with Monster. They're doing the energy brands for us. They're in the system. The bottlers make money. We make money. Monster make money. We make money on the P&L, and we make money on the capital. So everyone's done very well.
Okay. On the taxes, I could have bet that I was going to get that question tonight. So thank you. Good news, everybody believes we now have a good shot at tax reform. Bad news is nobody has a clue what it's going to look like. And so obviously we've done our modeling, et cetera, but it's a net, we believe it to, you know, obviously we've been saying we needed tax reform, so it is a positive. And it will impact our capital structure, it'll impact the ability to bring back cash, and clearly it'll impact our effective tax rate. So net's a positive.
And then on the board and enterprise risk, you know, I think the most important thing is if you look at our board, it has really gone through an incredible refresh also, where we have 7 new board members over the last 4 or 5 years, 4 years actually, less than 4 years. And that will continue. And certainly my role, I see my role as ensuring that, the board and I can support James in every way we can to make him and his leadership team successful. That's the role. And that means ensuring that we have the most refreshing board, the most agile board that deals with the governance issues is the best example for governance, and also to make sure that we work with James for the next cadre of leadership in the company, which is the most important thing that he talked about when he wants to hand the reins in whenever he does, you know, decades from now. So I think that's really the key, working with the CEO, and I will lead that work with him to make sure that we develop the best capability in the company. The pipeline is stronger than ever before. If you talk to anyone, you'll get that answer that, you know, undoctored talk inside the company, that's the answer you'll get. And I think we'll have to continue that. And getting the company younger, more digitized, the employees more digitized, and the company more digitized. That comes with the employees. It doesn't come any other way. You can't impose a digitization on a company if the people aren't willing to accept it and to run with it and to lead it. So that's how I see it. That not doing that is the biggest risk, and that's how I see my role. Great. Thank you all. Happy holidays to all of you, and thank you for your interest. Great. Thank you.
My soul and you're here right beside me. I don't ever want this day to end.
We can watch the fire, let it go while you sit here beside me.